feel like there's more exciting. So I'm going to go first. Do you remember the murder snail that I have? I told you about that, like, ate four of my fish.
Yes.
And who knows if it ate my shrimp or something. I thought it was going to come for me in the middle of the night. Anywho,
I sold them
on Marketplace. I sold the murder snail. I didn't tell people he was a murder snail. I told him he's a algae cleaner 3000. And he ended up selling. So someone really wanted him for their tank. And if they had asked about fish, I would have told them, but they didn't. And oh well. He hasn't killed my last two, so maybe he's on a different... He's turned a new leaf. I don't know. But he is no longer in my household threatening my other fish.
Does that make you an accessory? Of some capacity?
Not unless something happens, and nothing's happened so far. So I feel like I am a relieved victim in this.
You're gonna see in the news, my lucky stars. Three dead in a recent homicide, and this and this and that.
Slime trail leading away from the crime scene.
Honestly.
Oh, man. No. Well, we thought I had a buyer, and then he flaked out on me. And then this person, I was like, are you sure? Like, are you sure you're going to show up? And they're like, yeah, we'll show up. I'm like, okay. So he is on to bigger and better places, hopefully. And if not, it's not my concern, even though I would feel bad. But, yeah, that brings my anxiety down. What brought your anxiety down recently?
Quick thought on that. What's the going rate for a murder snail these days?
I didn't list him as a murder snail. So as he was, I said $5. But then I brought him down to $3. So I'm like, I do want him sold. My mentality was like, I was at the point I would pay someone to take him. But I figured people wouldn't take it seriously if he was free, you know? It's always like, oh, yeah, sure, right. Like, I'm not going to take care of it. I'm like, I want you to take care of him. So I got to put some price on him. And so I figured $5 was fair because he's a big snail. Like, he's worth a chunk of change.
I mean,
he's
just worth his weight in nickels. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You're gonna, oh God. Anyway. I hope he didn't go to get eaten.
Well, my anxiety is a lot lower today.
The lady was real excited about it. Yeah. Why is your anxiety down?
So, many, many podcasts ago, some of our more faithful listeners probably remember me saying something about like running out a couple like hours one way to go check out this truck.
I feel like this is pretty normal. Oh, well, truck specifically, yeah. No, but you running out hours away to go look at something is not out of the norm.
For sale. Yeah, exactly. I have a problem, but it could be much worse. I don't do
mittens
drugs.
Is the first step. We don't do murder snails either.
Or murder snails. Or snails or murder. So everything's here.
I'm glad we clarified that. Me neither, by the way, because anyone's wondering.
But anyway, so ended up doing a trade a couple months ago for a vehicle I had for this Toyota Tundra that, you know, it's lived a hard life. And someone was doing an oil change before my care. This is why I got it for such a, you know, my vehicle was old and had some issues, and so straight across trade, super cool. But it was it's a 2013 Tundra, newest vehicle I've ever owned. I would say nicest. Some people think that's probably a stretch. it's a good like 23 foot looker. Much closer, you'll start to see like all the character of it.
Goodness.
But yeah, so. Oil change was being done to it, and someone forgot to put a drain plug back in. So put all the new oil back in. This is not me. This is previous owner. Was whoever. Put the drain plug back in. Put oil in it, but had the drain pan still underneath it, so it did not make a mess when all that new oil just went right out the drain plug, or the drain hole.
Jeez.
And fired it up and ran it till it didn't. And so I got this nice paperweight and bought
Andrew deals with big fish. I deal with small.
Yeah, I traded a you know, I would say perfectly decent running driving 1995 Toyota T100 for 2013, almost 18 years of a newer vehicle.
Wow.
Straight across trade. And so I got a junkyard engine. Pulled out the old one, put the new one in, been doing a whole bunch of stuff. And last night went to start it for the first time.
Cool.
And when it first started, I got super anxious and nervous. It's like, I sure hope, I mean, it's a junkyard engine. It's like, you know, high stakes, rolling the dice, whatever you want to say, lottery. Like, you know, I can't afford to have a rebuilt engine. And so you still pay a lot and you really hope for the best and take the junkyard at their word. And, or,
but you got high stakes, high reward mentality.
Yeah. Yeah. This is how I get my fix. This is great. And so
you do have a problem. Just
really hoping that it fires and it's not like sounding terrible. And so we hit the key, it cranked, and it sounded like it had low compression, a couple cylinders, which for anyone who knows anything about vehicles or engines, you don't want to hear that. And then it fired up, and then there's a lot of clattering and like timing chain noises. You don't have to know what all this is, but there's lots of noises. It got better as oil pressure built up, and but then there was just like a just a knocking, like an incessant knocking.
Come in.
I know. I was just like, oh no, in this case, come out. But I really thought I had rod knock and I had a bad junkyard motor and all this. I just was crestfallen. So much time and money had gone into this. I was like, oh no. But long story short, long story long still, ended up putting more fluids in because, you know, I had drained a whole bunch of fluids from the engine, the transmission, all sorts of other stuff. And so I was like, well, I mean, if it's screwed up, it's screwed up. All I can do is like try to make it to where things are happy and we'll see if that fixes anything. Mm-hmm. And surprisingly, it did. So it's a lot happier. It ended up running quite joyfully sounding. It sounded like it actually wanted to be among the living, and it just made me, I'm so much more at peace today. Everything's fine. I did not waste a beautiful,
bright new day for you.
I did not waste a lot of money, but maybe, but I did not, you know, buy bad parts probably. I think it sounds happy. I think it's okay.
The third anyway, video you sent me sounds like it's purring happily.
It
like
sounds
a
lot better than when it first started. So
it was a little chaotic the first two videos. You know,
the whole low compression thing too. Like it was just, I think there was with the whole timing chains and no oil pressure for a bit. It just, the timing was a little slop or the, yeah, the, yeah, the timing was a little sloppy. Anyway, nobody really cares. It's not a triple expansion steam engine.
This
if it
has
was,
been, well, that is a whole other story, but this has been Engine 101 with Andrew. Vehicle Engine 101.
Just spit fire. Let me just fire hose. Like, this is what's happening. Anyway, I'm a happy-ish person. Like, I can't wait to actually, like, I haven't even driven it yet, and I've owned it for months. So, looking forward to...
Good to try something new eventually.
Getting it done. But anyway, that's that fun. Hello!
Ahoy!
And welcome to the End of the Ways podcast. It's a show about all things shipwrecks, murder snails, vehicle dilapidations, and more on, under, near, and around the Great Lakes and beyond. My name is Andrew, and I shall not be your captain tonight. You've heard enough from me this evening. I will depart.
He texted me, and he's like, am I reading or you? And I told him me, and he sent a very happy gif of that it wasn't him. I'm Michelle, and I'm your captain for today's entertainment. Welcome aboard this week's episode. We are happy campers over here, and I hope you guys are happy campers wherever you are, or find something to be happy about. It might be stressful, but maybe you lightered something that's been weighing you down in a while. So, if so, good on ya.
Good terminology usage there.
Thank you. As a little Christmas present to you, because this is the last week before Christmas, and I guess a gift to ourselves as well, we have a bit of a twofer today, a two-for-one special, a buy one, sink two free sort of a story. We are talking about the James W. Curran. I was going to look it up because I've been reading it, but I haven't actually said it in my head. Looks like Curran. We're going to go with Curran, not Curran. C-U-R-R-A-N. Let's move on. And the John A. McPhail, P-H-A-I-L, not like failing.
Yeah, it sounds like a joke. It's a bad joke.
This whole story is a bad joke. Anywho, these two, the Curran and the McPhail, were two car fairies who are fated now to remain together throughout time, though they are under the waves. TM, 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 TM. Can't take that. That's ours. I want it. Let's go back.
If someone would pay for the trademark for us, we'd appreciate that.
donations gladly accepted on our website, www.underthewayspodcast.com. We will get there, but until now, it is a verbal agreement. Let's go back to a time prior to the Mackinac Bridge being built and officially opened in 1957. While ferries still operate to and from Mackinac Island and the mainland today, the only way back then to essentially drive across the straits was via ferry. That is, unless the waters were completely frozen over and you wanted to risk the physical drive across. Car ferries were quite popular prior to the bridge being built. In fact, the use of ferries in the Straits of Mackinac started in 1881 with the introduction of four ferries who mainly carried railroad cars across. What happened? Andy's changing things and it's messing with my mind.
I deleted a second period.
Oh,
that's messed you up, was one period getting deleted.
I saw movement and it wasn't me. My hands are in my pockets.
If you feel like you don't make a big difference in this world, just know one period can stop the podcast.
And yeah, and you also never spent the night with a mosquito, so I don't know. Andy's choking and dying over there. It's great. Unmute. No.
Nope.
Okay. Cool. In fact, the use of ferries in the Straits of Mackinac started in 1881 with the introduction of four ferries who mainly carried railroad cars across, along with the occasional private vehicle. These four, the Algoma, the St. Ignace, the St. Marie, and the Chief Wadham, paved the way for the more strictly just car and people ferries. In the early 1900s, the area around the Straits shifted from primarily industry-based to one of tourism. The growing use of personal automobiles, as well as the expansion of the United States highway system, brought vacationers further north than ever before. Those wanting to continue on their journey north onto St. Ignace in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan could do so on the railroad ferries just mentioned prior, but taking a trip on one of these was oftentimes expensive and fairly infrequent, with them having to wait for the railroad schedules as well. Seeing the opportunity to cater to more tourists, the state of Michigan started their ferry service across the straits. The State Highway Department operated ferry service was the first of its kind and originally came to be through an act of state legislature. On August 2nd, 1923, the first Michigan state ferry, the Ariel, made her maiden voyage across the straits, starting in St. Ignace and ending in Mackinac City with a whole three cars on board. However, by the end of her first year, the Ariel had transported around 10,351 vehicles across the waves. Despite the growing popularity, the state wanted to provide a transportation link while not making much of a profit. Early rides were about a dollar a vehicle. Seeing the popularity that came along with the Ariel in 1923, the state of Michigan started employing more car ferries across the straits. The city of Mackinac and the St. Ignace were brought the second year in 1924, followed by the Straits of Mackinac in 1928, who from that point on was used as a flagship for this car ferry fleet. The Great Depression, which started in 1929, brought a decrease of tourists and traffic to the area, but this only lasted until the mid-1930s when things started picking up again. Which is weird, because the Great Depression lasted about 10 years, but the next year they're like, oh, let's keep traveling. Times keep going on.
Wheels keep moving.
The increase in traffic flow brought about more ferries joining in the fun. The city of Sheboygan was purchased in 1937, with the city of Munising being added the following year to offset the selling of some of the original ferries, the city of Mackinac and the St. Ignace, being they were sold to the federal government.
And
the
a quick interjection real quick. Like all of these city of, like this is, I these know. Are all ship names. Just
yeah, they're
a
all
reminder.
Ships. You're right.
The cities were not
the
being
actual
sold
ship,
off.
The city.
Yeah, so just a sidebar for anyone who's like getting lost in the sauce of the story, just to note, all of these cities of being sold and bought, they are ships.
Same with the St. Marie and St. Ignace and all sorts of stuff. Also, Saint with an E at the end of it. That's weird. But yeah, all these are ferries. The city of Petoskey, another ferry, was bought in 1940, and then the last ship to be added to the fleet was the Vacation Land, which was put into service in 1952. While crossing the straits today isn't much of a hassle, it was quite the ordeal and adventure back then. The busiest times of year were June, July, and August, along with the 3 days prior to opening day of deer hunting season in November. During these times, passengers could easily spend up to a few hours waiting for a ferry to take them to their final destination. Some people would try to earn a bit of extra cash by preparing sandwiches or pasties in order to sell them from car to car for those waiting in line and not wanting to get out of it. There are also stories of cars being lined up through neighborhoods, blocking people in their own driveways, as well as people, specifically tourists, accidentally getting caught up in said lines and held hostage for hours on end. I feel like some lines you can just get out of, but maybe they're horrifying. This has to lead to something really cool. And the next thing you know, you're on a ship.
Well, I mean, you wouldn't want to be like lose your place in line if it is something cool. And then you discover like, oh, it's just getting on a ferry.
Oops. Yeah. Well, took a wrong turn somewhere. Once on the ferry, passengers could take the around 45-minute, 5-mile long trip to enjoy scenic views of the two Michigan peninsulas, Mackinac Island, Round Island, and Bois Blanc Island. While the summer months and a few fall days definitely remained the busiest for the car ferries, some of them were able to operate year-round. A few of the ships, like the Vacationland and before it, the St. Marie, had reinforced hulls in order to help break through ice. The railroad car ferry Chief Wadham also was built to be a large ice-breaking ship. A lot of the ice-breaking was taken over when the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Mackinac entered into service for the area in 1944. Over the span of 34 years, from 1923 to 1957, the 9 car ferries that worked the Straits carried around 12 million vehicles and more than 30 million passengers between Mackinac City and St. Ignace. To help show how many trips that would have taken each of the ships, the first car ferry in the area, the Ariel, could only accommodate up to 20 cars, while the largest of the fleet, the City of Petoskey and the City of Munising, could each take about 105 vehicles, with the others somewhere in the middle, carrying 35 cars, 60 cars, and 85 cars. So that's a lot of vehicles in ships that don't hold a lot of vehicles. The construction of the Mackinac Bridge changed the course of the car ferries. When the bridge officially opened on November 1st, 1957, cars could now drive across the straits between Mackinac City and St. Ignace. This first day for the bridge was also the last day for car ferries. The last paying passengers arrived in St. Ignace coming from the Lower Peninsula on board the City of Petoskey around 1:45 p.m. on November 1st, and the last ever trip was by the Vacationland, who returned to Mackinac City with guests and highway department higher-ups getting to take the ride for free. This final trip on board the Vacationland included 135 cars and 674 passengers. Look at that smoke just billowing out. Makes your exhaust look really clear.
No, it is just belching black smoke.
And it's literally not, like you can't see through dissipating. It. It's black. it's sort of spreading
out and getting a little bit more like opaque, but like it's just, it's thick, full smoke. That's wild.
Oh, that's gross. Aside from no longer needing the car ferries, the bridge also came along with some commerce constraints put in place. It was now prohibited for any other car transit business to be operating within several miles of either side of the bridge. Also, I love this cake. This is Mackinac Bridge. It's kind of cool.
It's pretty neat. Middle of the bridge, just a couple of folks there just like, oh, let's have a cake just to celebrate this bridge, eh?
Yeah, and this is Mackinac Bridge, and it was before it was officially open, so pretty neat stuff. This pattern would slowly start to spread throughout other parts of the Great Lakes as various bridges were being built. In 1962, the Sault Ste. Marie International Bridge, which connected the cities of Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, and Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, over the St. Mary's River, was completed. However, before that, there were the ferries. The first ferry between the Twin Cities was the Grace. This steam-powered vessel started working along the St. Mary's River in 1873, then officially going, quote, between the two Sioux, end quote, in 1886. She was 24 feet long, 7.3 meters, and roughly the size, if not smaller, than a standard lifeboat for most Great Lake freighters today. That is wild. The Grace transported people, not vehicles, and could carry 4 passengers per crossing. After the Grace came the Louise, the Antelope, who was at the time also a part-time salvage vessel, the Flora Holden, and she ran 10 years before being condemned for who knows what, and the Camilla, the Elizabeth Peyton, the Courier, and the Lady May. All of these ships were run by Captain Charles Ripley and his crew. The first big acquisition of Captain Ripley was an 80-foot, 24.4-meter steam ferry called the International. And around this time, Ripley received his first competition when the J.J. Beckwith was put into service as well. But that didn't last long, as after the first year, both ship operators joined forces, utilizing both ships for both entities. The Beckwith later was sold and converted to a tug before wrecking on Lake Superior. In its place, two smaller ships, the Ivanhoe and the Mascot, joined forces with the International. The Ivanhoe ended up burning at the dock and was replaced by the June Haggerty. Around this time, Captain Ripley retired as an active ferry boat captain and instead took his ship, the International, to the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago. The International also had a rather interesting life and will be covered in a later episode. There were a lot of other ships bought, sold, and switched around during the next several decades on the St. Mary's between the two Sioux. The newly formed International Transit Company came into play and purchased a more modern ferry, the Algoma, along with her assets, the land of the current holder, Sault Ste. Marie Ferry Company, and a lease to a Perry dock in Sioux, Michigan for the low, low price of $80,000, which in today's money is about 11 million Canadian dollars. Which they got a lot for 11 million.
It's a lot of money.
The Algoma, while she was an improvement, was not designed to carry cars. Instead, the only vehicles allowed on board were horse-drawn carriages, who had to pay quite the hefty price, a whole quarter, to go across the river. But the Algoma was a steam engine and didn't always have the power to cross the river during the winter months, and oftentimes needed rescuing by the Coast Guard. Before the ferry started running on a 24-hour service, they used to only run during the navigation season, with rides ending around 8 p.m., Since there was no ferry to catch after hours during the wintertime, people were forced to walk across the frozen river water following a path of evergreens that were stuck in the snow-covered ice. However, the stretch of water closer to the Canadian side ran a bit faster and often didn't freeze as quickly as the other side. A small boat was often out there to ferry these people across for a small profit. That is, until the ferry business decided to start changing their last trip times later and later until they had in place a 24-hour, 12-month transportation business. In 1926, the Algoma was replaced by the first diesel-powered car ferry, the Algoming. At first, the Algoming could carry up to 24 cars per trip, but as the vehicles increased in size, she became limited to around 12 to 16 cars. The Algoming had proved herself useful, but with the growing number of automobiles, improved highway systems, and ever-growing tourist trade, like we discussed with the Straits of Mackinac, additional ferries were needed for people to cross the St. Mary's River. At the height of tourist season, lineups for the ferry would clog up traffic on streets in both cities. Many people would have to wait 4 to 5 hours just to cross the river, kind of what we said also with the Straits of Mackinac. And some people even ended up getting in line by mistake, thinking they were waiting to take a boat through the locks or on a lock boat tour, and instead found themselves on the way to Canada. Nightmare.
I mean, that happens to everyone, right?
I'm going to go take a tour of the locks. Oops, I'm in another country.
I mean, there's actually, like, I feel like it's in Detroit or something where there's a bridge that, I mean, there's signage and stuff, but, like, someone, if you make a wrong turn, you are on this bridge headed to Canada, and there's people who have been like, hey, I didn't mean to do this, I'm sorry. And, like, it's hours of just trying to.
That sucks.
Yeah. There's always got to be something.
I've done that before where it's like a park situation and you think it's free, but then you get up there and you're like, oh, it's actually not free, and turned around. But that's not waiting 4 to 5 hours and in line
and still and going whatnot. To Canada.
Yeah, and still going there. Luckily, it was before they needed passports, so at least there's that. In 1947, the James A. Curran was added, and then in 1955, the John A. McPhail joined the ranks. These three ships ran until the new International Bridge was built in 1962. In order to sell the bridge, building bonds needed to raise the funds for such a structure, a guarantee of a, quote, no ferry system operating within 5 miles of the bridge, end quote, was established. The record for the greatest number of cars to ever cross on the ferries in this area was set on August 18, 1962, when 3,425 cars were transported across the St. Mary's River.
That's a lot of cars.
Especially if they can only take 16 or so. Well, I think the later two could take more. The use of car ferries here for cross-river trade lasted a few years, but in 1964, two of the working vessels in the area, the James W. Curran and the John A. McPhail, found themselves being officially decommissioned and on their way to be refitted in Kingston, Ontario. The two ships were owned by the Ontario Department of Highways, and after their refittings, were going into service for Wolfe Island in Ontario. On their way to Kingston, the Curran was being towed by the tug G.W. Rogers, and followed behind, chained to the Curran, was the McPhail. But let's first back up a bit. Again, the MV James W. Curran was built in 1947 at the Collingwood Shipbuilding Company in Ontario. She was 103 feet long, 34.1 feet wide, and had about an 8-foot draw. And in metric, that's 31.4 meters by 10.4 meters by 2.4 meters deep. The Curran was made of steel, had 189 gross registered tonnage, and was powered by a diesel engine with a dual shaft capped by two screw propellers. She's a very interestingly shaped boat, which I guess is a car ferry.
Yep. It's almost she looks like cars, and that's about it. Maybe people too.
There's a few people on board somewhere, but yeah, that's wild. Back to the other boat, the MV John A. McPhail was also built at the Collingwood Shipbuilding Company in Ontario, but this time in 1955. She was similar in dimensions to the Curran, coming in at 115.2 feet long by 36.1 feet wide and having a draw of 8 feet, which translates to 35.1 meters long, 11 meters wide, and 2.44 meters deep. The McPhail was powered by two diesel engines and also had a dual shaft with two screw propellers. Her gross registered tonnage was 186 tons, and both ships were touted as being capable of carrying around 18 vehicles and 450 passengers each. I don't know if that was at the same time. I think it's 18 vehicles or 450 passengers.
Because I don't that many people. No, on you this can't. Boat.
Even without the cars, I feel like that's a lot of people.
Standing room only.
I feel the like you'd have to stack them like sardines. Behind,
like being like, hanging onto a rope.
You get the discount swim special. Around 6:40 a.m. on Friday, May 8th, 1964, the Canadian dredge and dock company tug, the G.W. Rogers, left Sault Ste. Marie with the empty Curran and McPhail in tow. The skies were sunny with some partial cloud cover, and the Curran was the one directly tied to the tugboat, like we said, but about 200 feet back, with the McPhail around 100 feet behind her. This small fleet was en route from Salt Lake City. Not Salt Lake City. What a trip.
That from was a Sault Ste. Very short trip. One side of the lake to the other.
Oh, man. Right here. Don't diss our ever-shrinking lake. The small fleet was en route from Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, over to Kingston, also in still in Ontario, Canada. Once there, the two ferries were scheduled to receive some major dry dock repairs before being returned into service, but this time carrying passengers and cars from Kingston to Wolfe Island, like we said. This 5-day trip overall would take the vessels through Lakes Huron, Erie, and Ontario before reaching the eastern end of Lake Ontario. As the group of boats began their journey along the St. Mary's River and into Lake Huron, the waves started getting bigger. Not normally a big deal for the G.W. Rogers, as it had means of draining water that ended up making its way inside. However, for the Curran and the McPhail, these ferries were built for the river, not wide open lakes, and certainly not inclement weather on the Great Lakes. These ferries lacked any large freeing ports in which drains water that gets on board, accumulates, and causes instability. Also, due to being built for calmer river waters, the ferry's hulls stuck up from the chine or sharp angle where the bottom of a boat's hull meets the sides. And for the ferries, this was basically the upper edge of the main vehicle deck, which formed a steel wall about 4 feet high, like a bulwark, in order to keep water from splashing onto the deck. Captain Gilbert Burt Harris hoped that this would be enough to keep the water out of the ships during the worsening waves, as he chose to continue on the journey. But waves soon weren't his only concern. Once the fleet reached Lake Huron, the seas were getting more choppy and large ominous clouds were gathering to their southwest. Captain Harris had made sure the crew had set the tether wire between themselves and the current back far enough that the 11/4-inch steel tow line would submerge underwater, acting as a buffer between the tug and the ferries.
What's 11/4 steel, like inch steel? Is it 1 1/4?
Maybe, and I just didn't space it, and I followed suit. 2.75.
11/4-inch steel.
Steel cable. What is this? It's I bet it's supposed to be 1 1/4. You're welcome. You're welcome. You're right. I think it's supposed to be 1 1/4, and he didn't make a space, and then I sure didn't either. That makes more sense. I was like, wow, what a weird... Oh, well, not my problem.
Otherwise, it'd be 3...
2.75.
Yeah, yeah, 2 3/4 inch.
That's bigger, for it sure.
But I mean, that's, like, huge.
1 1/4 inch is still pretty massive for a steel tow line, right?
Yeah, that's...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty big there, bud. That'd be, yeah.
That reminds me of a video I saw. This guy was snowboarding and an avalanche started, but it was like he was filming himself, but then it was like drones and other people, so you saw like multiple angles of when this avalanche started right under him, and someone was like, keep eyes on him or whatever, and then he made it out luckily. He's like, oh, good thing I like practiced surfing or whatever, and someone's like, there you go, buddy, you got it. It was so cute. I was like, there you go, buddy.
You survived.
You did die.
You survived. Good job.
Way to go, buddy. Yeah. Oh, man.
A little clap on the back.
As his heart's like racing. Captain Harris had made sure the crew had set the tether wire between themselves and the current back far enough that the 1 1/4-inch steel tow line would submerge. We suspect it's 1 1/4 inch. How I read it was 11/4, which makes no sense, and Andrew definitely called that out. So thank you for that correction corner.
Math.
Live and in person. This submerged line would act as a buffer between the tug and the ferries, which I didn't know they did that. That's kind of cool. Just submerge a line, and it's a smoother trip. I don't know. 2 hours into the trip, the winds were reaching about 35 to 40 knots, and the waves were now around 10 to 15 feet high, with some even higher in places. The GW Rogers, at her own 93 feet or 28 meters in length, was pushing ahead at full power with her 1,000-horsepower diesel engine whining in the wind. Captain Harris ordered his crew to let out more tow line to reduce any sudden jerking motions caused by the waves. He assumed that if the ships became separated, there would be no hope of recovering any of them. The current was now about 270 feet behind the tugboat. The wind started letting up a bit, with the direction now coming out of the west, and Captain Harris, on board the tugboat, being a well-seasoned shipmaster who had run tugboats along the Great Lakes his entire career so far, replotted his course line. He felt a storm brewing and wanted to play it safe by staying on the western and American side of Lake Huron to use the land to help protect from the strong winds. Harris also figured that there were more opportunities for safe haven harbors along Michigan should he need them. As the day progressed, the seas kept building. Around 3 p.m., a call came over the radio about a tornado threat somewhere in Michigan. Dark clouds continued to build to the west, and Captain Harris steered the tug out from Presque Isle Light and set his course to take the ships further into the lake in order to clear Thunder Bay Island Light, which was still several miles ahead. The rough seas were making everyone a little seasick, and no warm meals were cooked that evening. Later that night, some of the crew went to bed in order to try and get some rest before having to relieve the current crew around midnight. The storm only grew worse and worse. It became harder and harder to see the Curran and the McPhail over the waves separating all of the ships. Just after midnight, panic was settling through the crew as they finally spotted the Curran, who was leaning to one side and sitting quite low in the water. Captain Harris radioed the U.S. Coast Guard station at Harbor Beach, Michigan, telling them they were about 30 miles north of Point O'Barks. Harris told the Coast Guard that both ferries in tow were rolling quite badly and that one, the Curran, appeared, quote, to be listing with little or no freeboard, end quote. Crew members struggled to aim the mounted searchlight at the ships with the tossing and turning going on. All at once, one of the crew shouted that the Curran had, quote, gone right over, and, quote, onto her side and was sinking. Harris told the crew to let out the tow line or to cut it completely to avoid being dragged down with the ship. The crew let loose the wire and it started disappearing into the dark water, coil after coil. Not wanting to fully lose the wire, the crew slowed the winch and brought it back down to a stop. By this time, the G.W. Rogers was also brought to a halt. The tug was now anchored by the sunken current, with the MacPhail helplessly floating right behind her. But the line to the MacPhail was shorter, and she was already struggling to stay afloat. Finally, shortly before dawn, the heavily listing MacPhail also slipped under the waves. In the end, weather reports in the area later indicated that there was indeed either a tornado in the Michigan area and or a waterspout that caused winds to gust more than 80 miles per hour and caused widespread damage between Windsor and Toronto, Ontario. Most sources said that the fleet hit the tail end of a waterspout. And think of this as another ADHD side quest brought to you by our researcher and not another tangent, but did you know that there are two distinctly different types of waterspouts?
No, I didn't. Tell me more.
Well, thanks. There are tornadic water spouts. Well, tornado, it's not tornado. There are tornadic water spouts that form over water and sometimes move from land to water. These water spouts very closely resemble land tornadoes and bring with them severe thunderstorms, high winds and seas, dangerous lightning, and sometimes large hail. Tornadic waterspouts develop downward during a thunderstorm, and then there are the fair weather waterspouts, which sounds oxymoronic. These tend to be way less dangerous and can happen during relatively calm weather and bring along rain showers with the occasional non-severe thunderstorm. And opposite from tornadic ones, fair weather waterspouts develop on the surface of the water and work their way upward. With the disaster that ensued, it's probably safe to say that the Curran and the MacPhail were caught up in a tornadic waterspout. And for future reference, if you see a waterspout while out in the water, head at a 90-degree angle from the apparent motion of the funnel and never move closer to investigate the storm. For some reason, I'm more scared of tornadoes than waterspouts, even though it's like the same thing. I think of a waterspout, I'm like, oh, that's cute.
I mean, it's very scary to look at, but I feel like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it's the same for me. Mentally, it's also like, if that picks me up, it'll drop me on the water, and hopefully I'm not so high that it's not like falling onto concrete, but
yeah,
there's a higher chance of it being softer than a house or something.
It's picking up fish and plants, which, okay, that is a nightmare, but it's better than like trees and cows and houses and... Yeah, I don't know.
Yep.
I think I could take the one on the right in this picture. The one on the left, probably not.
Tornadic activity with fish than with cows.
The more I think about it, maybe not. Yeah, you know what? I respect the cyclones. I don't know. Don't look at me with that tone. Of course, with all wrecks, there are some speculation as to whether or not the ships broke loose during the weather, were cut loose due to safety measures in the storm, such as pulling the tug down, or if they were cut loose intentionally for insurance purposes, and a storm was just the perfect excuse or cover-up. Luckily, no one was aboard either ferry when they sank, and the two ships sank in about 200 feet of water, about 61 meters, which luckily didn't cause them to be a hazard to other ships navigating the area. Pretty easy cleanup, as there was none. Chris Roxburgh, a very talented underwater shipwreck photographer, posted a picture of the MacPhail with a short description of what happened to her on Facebook. In his comment section, one Randy Johnson posted about a Windsor Star article that apparently came out on May 11th, 1964, a few days after the ship sank. To be fair, when our researcher tried searching for this article herself, she was unsuccessful, so take all of this with a grain of salt. But according to this article, the United States Coast Guard set out to try and figure out why these two vessels, both just over 100 feet in length, sank. Captain Harris on board the tug said that the cause of the sinking of the Curran, quote, which went down around 3 a.m. Saturday, was unknown, end quote. The article mentioned that Harris said the voyage had been uneventful and, quote, the weather had not been bad and everything seemed all right, end quote. Captain Harris told the newspaper that there was some considerable fog out, but the Curran just seemed to, quote, found her in sync, end quote. He then went on to say that about an hour after the Curran sank, his crew was preparing to board the McPhail and cut the lines that still attached her to her sunken comrade when she too started to sink. Now, you might be wondering why the crew waited a whole hour before climbing aboard the McPhail, and apparently it's because they were waiting for the proper equipment to cut the cables, which was brought out by the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Acacia, who responded to the call.
I was wondering that, actually. Thank you.
Before you even asked it. The crew on board the Acacia noted that the waters had a heavy swell, larger waves, when they arrived on scene. These swells were accompanied by strong northwesterly winds, but the Coast Guard wasn't sure if these conditions were present when the first ship sank. Unfortunately, they arrived just in time to watch the McPhail sink as well, and the article stated that, quote, the towing bridle on the McPhail had been pulled underwater by the weight of the other ferry and that the vessel was taking on water, end quote. Also, we're about to get into some photos for Andrew. Oh, you guys will see it soon. The photo of the Curran was the first one I saw, and it freaks me out. And you will see why shortly. But there's a lot of cool photos of this. All in all, most sources claimed the sinking was due to bad weather that continued to worsen throughout the day and into the overnight. The Marine Inspection Office of the U.S. Coast Guard believed it was possible to raise both vessels again. A permit for recovery was even acquired in 1969, but for whatever reason, it never happened. The sunken ferries were first discovered underwater in the 1980s by Stan Stock, and then they were rediscovered by the Undersea Research Associates, or URA, while the group was surveying Lake Huron with their Klein side scan sonar. Chris Roth, Cindy Lynch, and Michael Lynch, photographers and divers in the Great Lakes, went down to visit the wreck in 1997. They revisited again 20 years later in 2017. And Chris, in his YouTube video, mentions that while still spooky, the water is a lot clearer and the wrecks didn't have any zebra mussels on them on their first dive, but now they are completely covered in them. There are a few photos we'll try to include in our socials that show the difference in zebra mussel presence within a 20-year period, which is wild. And you can see it with the steering wheels.
Yeah, it's insane how many mussels have accumulated in relatively short order.
20 years. That's quick. Today, the two ships still remain tethered together a minimum of 20 miles offshore from anywhere. The McPhail sits upright on the bottom of the lake bed in around 215 feet of water, while the Curran, the one I saw in the picture, is suspended upside down about 150 feet away. Still upside down. I thought it was
upside down.
It's just so well, if you look at the picture, it looks, I thought it was just free floating. Go down. Scroll down.
I have.
I saw this one. I don't know if you can see the one I highlighted.
Yeah.
That one. So initially, I didn't see the ground. I thought it was just free floating above the other one still. And I thought that was creepy because it's just wrapped up in wires and the towing cable still. I didn't realize it was on the bottom as well and like propped up. But I thought it was free floating and that freaked me out. The fact that it's upside down is weird too. Also, apparently if you're a diver, it's very disorienting. And some people can get stuck.
Can be.
Can be.
You don't know our audience. Hometown.
I would be disoriented and get stuck if I ever found myself in that situation, which I don't think I ever would. So I guess I'd be okay. I have higher faith in you guys. You're right. I shouldn't judge our audience like that. I'm sorry. You dive where you want to dive safely. Today, the two ships remain tethered. We said that the Curran is suspended upside down about 150 feet away from the McPhail. The Curran is being held up by her pilot house, wrapped up in the tow cable and at a 45-degree angle. Some think that the Curran turtled or flipped over before she sank, but one source mentioned it as like happening once she already had sank, but I think sources are mainly saying that she turtled and flipped over before she sank, and then she sank and just stayed upside down. So but yeah, that one was the one that would have been anchoring the tugboat in that area and then pulling down the other one, which she would have been suspended for a while if she's like 200 feet down and the rope was only 100 feet. So, ugh. Yeah. I hate all of it. It makes me so uncomfy. There's some really cool photos by Chris Roxburgh and Becky Kagan Schott and all these people. We'll credit the photos to them, obviously, when we're on social, so you guys can look at more photos, but it's just...
super cool. Super wild. It's creepy. A shame, too. Like, these fairies have been doing their due diligence and, like, doing a great job with all their work for all these years. All right, you're retired. Let's go send you to get refit. Bloop, bloop,
bloop. Like, just sink.
That sucks. That's rough.
But hey, at least they aren't alone. As a funny aside, the Underwater Research Associates, URA, that we mentioned earlier, that found the wreck after the initial dive did. Associates. The Underwater Research Associates, URA, that we mentioned earlier, found the wreck after the initial diver did. They attempted to sell the coordinates, the Curran and the McPhail, on eBay in 2003. The bidding started at $100, and no one bid on it, that's according to blurb about it on Baylod.com, the personal website run by Brendan Baylod, whom we've covered quite a few of his found wrecks, including the Trinidad in episode 56. But on his website, he said the money, quote, would have been a nice way to defray wreck hunting expenses, but divers are a cheap bunch, end quote. That is not my saying, that is his. So you could have had the coordinates, because apparently not a lot of people know where these ships are, for $100 back in 2003. So... You snooze, you lose. But, indeed. Yeah, that is the story of the two-for-one deal of the Curran and the McPhail, two car ferries now fated to stay together in Lake Huron. But no one died.
That's good.
That is a good twist.
That is a good thing.
Seeing the comments under these photos, like on Facebook, people are like, oh my gosh, these poor people who died. It's like, no one was on it. It was empty. It's an empty ship. It is cool. On the McPhail, she has some spare props in some crates because those are going to be outfitted on both of the ships, and they're still in their crates.
Yeah, so, that's wild. That's super cool.
Those are some heavy things to stay in the ship as she sinks, but yeah, those are the ships.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Good story.
Thanks for listening. I appreciate you.
Here we are. Well, last week's trivia, we didn't have any, though we talked a lot about ice volcanoes. This week's trivia, what country, hint it's not the United States or Canada, traditionally decorated small boats instead of Christmas trees? It is still a common practice today, despite the growing popularity of Christmas trees.
Can we bring this back? This is cute. Granted, a tree is cheaper than a boat. But yep. Like, hey.
Hey, if we bring this back, does that mean affordability is
improving? I think you're saying, does the price of eggs go down? Maybe. Oh, man. I saw someone who quick side note, parked a boat in their driveway and their HOA got mad because you're not supposed to do that. So they put a potted plant on top of it and said, no, this is my garden now. This isn't a boat. And apparently you can have gardens in your driveway or like potted plants or something. So they squeaked around the rules because they put a plant on it.
Yep, exactly. The letter of the law. Beautiful. Bobsled on by here next week for more Great Lakes and Shipwreck Adventures. The last one of the 2025 year, which how wild is that? Make sure to send us all of the ships, the lighthouses, the ghosts, the trivia, the personalities, the disasters, the winds, and all things Great Lakes that you would like for us to cover in the new year 2026. You can submit those to our email underthewavespodcast@gmail.com. See the pictures associated with today's episode on our socials, which can be found when you search Under the Waves Podcast on your favorite platforms. And check out our website, which it's still not too late to get that last minute gift for yourself, you deserve it, or a loved one, www.underthewavespodcast.com. We're almost through the holiday season for those who are trying to race through it, and if you're not, no worries. Christmas is just around the corner, and you can celebrate as wildly as you'd like. Remember, you don't have to engage in any conversations you don't wish to. If you don't feel safe, have a number you can call that can help, or just slip an earbud into your ear. That makes sense. And listen to our charming voices spend time with you during the potentially tumultuous holiday time. And if you're in a safe place surrounded by people you can count on, we absolutely love that for you and are so happy to hear it. In the meantime, links for all things mental health, government cause struggles, and bettering life for others and yourself a little bit can be found in our show notes. We love you, we're proud of you, and we are going to make it to the new year. Just you wait. And remember, we try to say this every holiday, but especially this year, you don't have to discuss politics, religion, personal beliefs, or anything with anybody. Keep that to yourself if you want, or create chaos if that's your preferred method. Whatever helps the voices in your head sleep at night.
Mine never sleep. Share this with someone who needs a little bit of Christmas cheer spread their way. Preferably the person who's been walking around acting like the ghost of Christmas exhaustion since November. Share this with a friend who's one burnout away from telling Santa to circle back to quarter one. Or share this with a person who keeps saying, I'm not doing gifts this year, but you just know we'll show up with a last minute present wrapped in a Target bag. And make sure to pass this along to the person who hasn't watched a single Christmas movie because they're too unrealistic and they don't feel like it's actually December yet, despite the month being almost over. Or maybe share this episode with someone who just needs a reminder that Christmas cheer doesn't have to mean blasting Frank Sinatra, Michael Bublé, or Mariah Carey at 7 a.m. each morning. In fact, it can be as simple as remembering the joy in simple things such as cookies, fuzzy socks, and peppermint-flavored anything. And honestly, share this episode, and maybe an extra hot chocolate, with someone who could use a laugh, a hug, or even an extra helping of whipped cream on top of their cocoa. Because even if the holidays feel chaotic, there's still plenty of sparkle left. You just might have to dig through the wrapping paper pile to find it.
We release new episodes every Friday, and until then, folks, fair winds and following seas.
We'll catch you next time under the waves. Bye!
Cheers. Apple cider's better.
No. Lame. Let's try. Oh god, which button? This one. Okay.